With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back, everybody. Chad Hartman with you. A man has joined us a number of times over a couple decades here. Mike Ostrom is with us, the doctor, who his resume is just brilliant. Regent Professor McKnight, Presidential Endowed Chair in Public Health at the U of M and the Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research, former state epidemiologist, and on so many panels and so essential to so many of us during challenging times. And this is just such a challenge that our nation hasn't faced in 100-some years. Mike, always a pleasure. Mike is with us on the CenterPoint Energy Home Services Plus hotline. Mike, as we talk today on a Friday afternoon, give me your top two or three concerns as we stand here today.
Right now, my number one concern is and will continue to be we don't have the national leadership we need to direct this. We don't really know what's going on except from day-to-day press conferences and tweets. And what we have are 50 different governors who are leading the way, many of them doing heroic work, trying their very best to provide leadership on what this all means, what to do, how to stop it, how to interpret it. And so until we get that, I think we're in real tough shape. How do we get through this for the next 12 to 18 months? This is not a 2 or 3 month event. You know, in 1918, when the influenza pandemic struck, it took almost 2 years before it finally swept through the entire population. And so while in 1918 there were several big waves of it, there were waves in 1919 right into 1920. We're going to see the same thing here. So, you know, we can't shelter in place for 18 or more months waiting for a vaccine. There are many reasons why that's the case, not the least, of course, which is just how we provide essential services. On the other hand, we just can't let it go willy-nilly. I mean, people have to understand the impact of this would be huge. Mm-hmm. You know, despite all these kinds of estimates of what might happen, I can just give you a very simple one. It's not unreasonable to expect 1.6 million deaths from this in the country over the course of the coming months. And so we can't just let this thing just go, you know, uncontrolled. So what we have to do is find a middle ground. We have to thread the needle with the rope and figure out how do we open things back up among the population who is the least likely to have severe illness, which are the younger population. How do we basically protect and shelter those who are most likely to be infected? How do we keep our healthcare systems going? When we have so little protective equipment today, healthcare workers are on the front line. It's as if they have no vests, they have no bullets in their infectious disease gun, and they're in front of a viral Uzi. You know, how do we take care of them? What do we do? So these are the kind of plans we need right now, for which we don't have any. And that's not a partisan statement. Anyone listening on here may take it as such. I'd call it any way I see it. I call it balls and strikes, just the way I see it. And that's our huge challenge right now. I don't know what we're going to do.
Okay, that's a tremendous amount to unpack. But the part that is going to grab people the most, Mike, you know, is when you've said, and you've been right on these numbers, that it's not unreasonable to expect that 1.6 million Americans could die over the next 6 months. What is the likelihood of that? And how effective right now is the physical distancing and the stay-at-home orders in trying to bring those numbers down? I know you just pointed out a number of areas we have to be better, but when people hear that number, that is just going to startle them.
Well, you know, it's a number we've been using all along, and, you know, it's not black box. You know, there have been all these models, these statistical assumptions made to come up with numbers. And, you know, I've always ascribed to the fact that all models are wrong and some do provide useful information. And so, you know, let me just take a back of the envelope kind of way that, you know, we can understand this at the local coffee shop. There's 320 million Americans. Easily half will get infected. Every pandemic we've had like this, at least half the population gets infected, even with social distancing, you know, playing some role. Well, that's 160 million people. Of that 160 million people that get infected, and this could go for 12 to 18 months, this whole period, if you look at that 160 million, about 80% will have very mild to moderate illness, likely not even needing health care. Of the remaining 20%, about 10% will likely see a physician or try to, but not necessarily need to be hospitalized. The remaining 10% will be hospitalized, which will give you, in a sense, then just right there, what we're talking about in terms of numbers. That's over 10 million. And of that, about half, 5%, will likely need intensive care medicine. We're seeing in many places around the world today, including New York, Detroit, New Orleans, et cetera, where the intensive care units are overrun. Then of that 5%, overall 1% will likely die. That's exactly what we've seen in China. That's exactly what we're seeing in Europe. That's exactly what we're seeing in the United States. That 1% of 160 million is 1.6 million. You know, no magic here. No. Black box. That's just the reality. And what we need to do is to figure out how we're going to try to reduce that without at the same time closing down our economy. And I get so nervous when I say that, because I want people to think this is a dollar and cents issue. You know, we don't have to make a dichotomous decision between saving lives and our economy. But, you know, think about what every day we need police, we need fire, we need food. You know, you can't do garbage pickup by working remotely. I mean, there's just so many.
So how do we do that, Mike? Because it's such an important point, and these numbers are so important, and they're based on modeling. At the same time, understand we don't want to just cease to exist economically. We don't want to come off callous when we say that. But where are we at now, realistically, trying to get people back who can go out and about more, who don't have to stay at home as much, without putting them at risk also?
See, and the problem we have today, Chad, is that we have 50 different states each trying to deal with this because there's no national leadership on it. There is no plan. There is nothing in the books that is being done that will help us get to that. I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times last weekend that actually called for basically an intellectual Manhattan Project, where we bring the best minds in public health, medical ethics, intensive care medicine, public policy, business, you know, the pharmaceutical world, all these groups together and say, okay, we're not leaving this room here for the next 2 to 3 days till we craft out a plan that actually every American can understand what it's about, why the decisions were made as they were, and what we're going to do to get through this. We're not going to be in lockdown for 18 months. Not going to happen. Number two is we're not going to let this virus go willy-nilly and just go through our communities and cause all these deaths. And I have to tell you, it would be a lot higher than 1.6 million if we let that happen, because one of the things we hit is we hit basically a treatment cliff. Once you lose your ventilators, you don't have any more. Once your intensive care medicine can't be provided, the case mortality rate goes up precipitously. You know, it's kind of like the old days of medicine, you know, long before we had intensive care medicine, just people just died. And so we don't want to get to that tipping point where we're at that medical care cliff where we can't provide care. So we've got to hold those numbers down. And on top of it, we've got to protect our healthcare workers. You know, we already have hundreds of healthcare workers who have become infected just right in this country trying to provide care. When we lose medical care people, particularly in the intensive care side, when you lose them, you're not just losing someone who's a doctor or a nurse. You're losing a special forces person, because just no other doctor or nurse can just fill in the intensive care ward. These are highly trained, really expert individuals. And when they go from becoming a care provider to now somebody needing care, that is a huge issue.
Okay, so if we had a national plan, Mike, and because some people are going to say, it's a twofold here. Some are going to say, well, what's happening in New York is not happening in, let's say, Idaho, or it's not happening in Wyoming. How do we balance that out? And then when we see the fact that we're so woefully behind on ventilators and masks and gowns. If we had a national plan and we had these brilliant minds as Manhattan Project, do you think those issues couldn't be not completely resolved, but we would make immeasurable progress that is not happening right now?
Those decisions that we need to make will never be easy, and there's never going to be a perfect answer. But if you bring together the best minds, we have a better chance of answering them. And in terms of the whole world being either red or blue, I'll tell you right now, the color of COVID is going to be neither. It's going to be black. And what we have to understand is even today in those areas that appear not to have much activity, they will. And in rural Minnesota already, we're seeing a big uptick in cases that are out there. All it takes is one long-term care facility to get the virus in that, and it'll amplify in that community overnight. And then it'll get into the local community hospital. That will literally almost shut that place down by the nature of the transmission. And so I tell people, you know, it's not going to hit everybody at once. I've already said this is a 12 to 18-month situation. And some places will get hit later than others. But the bottom line is this virus will find you. This is a virus that is going to spread through our communities, and we have to listen very carefully about when to do shutdowns, how. One of the things that we have here in Minnesota is a whole system in place to try to understand when influenza-like illness or muscle aches, fever, chills, et cetera, occur in populations seeing doctors' offices. We actually saw an uptick in that percentage of cases literally 3 weeks ago that was not related to flu at all, but it was related to COVID-19 circulating in this state. And so I think that one of the things people will understand is think about the average flu season. When we have a bad flu season, there isn't a county, there isn't a state, there isn't a city that's spared. It hits them all, sometimes at different times, but it hits them all. This is going to do the same thing. So we've got to get away from this red-blue notion. We've got to get away from urban-rural. Yes, some places will get hit harder first. Some places will get hit less hard first. Some places are going to get hit hard later, and some places later are going to get hit more moderately. But the bottom line is we're all going to get hit. And that's why this has to be a national response that really is based on the best science we have.
A couple last points, because I know you have to go. The mass conversation for everyday citizens that is taking place right now. L.A. a couple of days ago, the mayor saying we are recommending these. Bill de Blasio, the New York City mayor, saying it. The CDC seems to be leaning that way. There are reports the White House may recommend it today. World Health Organization has pushed back a little bit. How do people try to make that decision? They won't have access to the top flight masks, but for Minnesotans listening or other people online listening, what should they do about some version of a mask going forward?
Well, first of all, I'm making the assumption that everybody is trying to do whatever they can to make a difference. Yep. And I think that's to be applauded and appreciated. But at the same time, we have to take a step back and use our best science to say, is this going to actually help or make things worse? And if it does both, even, how do we make a decision when to do it or not? Is the worse better than the help? Well, in this case, this is a complicated issue and a confusing one, so I can understand if the public's confused. The N95 respirators, these tight face-fitting masks that actually have a special material, it's not even a cloth, it's a poured matrix material that serves as the mask, allows air to come through readily, but it traps all the viruses. It's a tight face fit so you don't get any leakage. That's what we have to preserve for our healthcare workers.
Sure.
We're going to be far, far short of that. Then we actually have the kind of surgical mask, which is present, throughout the community, which basically that was always meant not to protect you, but to protect others against large droplets, meaning a surgeon sitting over someone talking and potentially sneezing, whatever, getting the wound. Somehow that got translated to say, well, you know, that's going to help protect me a lot.
Yep.
It's very limited. The side face vents, where basically it's not close to the face on the sides, air will come right in and out of that. The virus is in that air. It's in and out. So what we do, though, is we put these masks on sick people, because if they do cough, then the larger particles will get trapped in the cloth, but the aerosols, the kinds of small little particles, will float right out the sides. So what the logic here now is that we're going to put these on everybody with the idea that it will stop some of the virus from being transmitted from them when they're asymptomatic, meaning in those first couple of days when they may not have symptoms. We assume if you're sick, you shouldn't be in public anyway, okay?
Sure.
So the mask shouldn't be even part of the discussion.
Correct.
But the problem is putting them on well people basically doesn't stop the virus if it's in these aerosols, these very tiny little from coming off the sides of the vents. So you don't really stop anything. It's much more cosmetic than real. If this was really that effective, we had just virtually almost every person in Hubei province in China before this outbreak ever took off because of a cultural issue wearing these things, and it didn't do anything to stop it. And so what I'm worried about is if we do recommend these, we're going to cannibalize, we're going to use up, we're going to find all the surgical masks that healthcare workers could use that we offer them, not perfect protection like the N95, but when we don't have any more N95s, we got to give them surgical masks. And if we lose that ability and those healthcare workers have nothing, then that is really a challenge. So I urge people, if you're going to do something, if you want to use a cloth mask, somehow use it. Know that I don't believe, or none of my colleagues, that this is going to really have a major positive impact. But whatever you do, please don't use a surgical mask. Don't go try to find them. Don't try to take them, because, in fact, we got to save them for our healthcare workers. That's the last hope they have.
We're going to end on that note. Mike, thanks so much. Stay
Thank
healthy,
you.
My friend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Much.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.